Right, class, welcome to back to English 307. So today we're going to be discussing Walt Whitman, and we're looking at the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass, and as well as the preface to the edition of Leaves of Grass. And before we start about the text, I'm going to go into a little bit of biography about Whitman and talk a little bit about how the work was received, and talk a little bit about his upbringing and background. And one note I'll make about the text is there's multiple editions of Leaves of Grass. It's a book that Whitman writes throughout his life. He revises it and adds sections and sections. So it's really kind of one giant evolving compendium of poems, and the section that we're looking at now is the most famous part, which is Song of Myself. But as the editions progress, he adds much to the to Leaves of Grass. The very first edition, the 1855 edition, has even more sort of peculiar punctuation. It's more fragmented. It has many ellipses in it. But if you compare the two editions that are often read the most are the 1855 one and the, what's, I think it's 1891, 1892, what's called the, deathbed edition, which is the edition that Whitman, wrote on his deathbed. Most often that is considered the definitive edition. But I think the 1855 is interesting to sort of see as, to see Leaves of Grass and to see Song of Myself in its first incantation, its first incarnation as, and the kind of energy that it has, because Whitman is sort of, known for being a poet who, is a path making poet, that he changes literary style. And is often thought of as sort of a transitional figure to modern poetics and modernist poetics. And so when you look at the 1855 edition, you can kind of see its ecstatic and its exuberant qualities, particularly in the more fragmented way that it is written. Although when you look at the deathbed edition, you can see that there's really a lot of similarities as well. So Whitman is born in 1819 in Huntington, Long Island, and he lives to 1892, so much longer than a lot of the other authors that we're looking at. And he was famous in his lifetime, but I'm not going to sort of get too much into biography. But I want to sort of mention a little bit about his childhood and his upbringing, because it is interesting to think about in relation to the poems. So he spends most of his life in Brooklyn, but he grows up in Long Island. He even grows up at a time in the early 1800s where there were still slaves in Long Island. So he talks about having known, having befriended a slave. And so early on, he has some contact, particularly being sort of in Long Island and being of a working class background. He has contact with slaves who are living there at that time. And another important sort of feature of Whitman's background is that his parents were largely influenced by Quakerism, or very interested in Quakerism. And if you get the chance to look it up, I do encourage you to do that and to sort of see about Quakerism and some of the ideas. But it's a very unorthodox, a very kind of progressive form of Christianity. And his parents are particularly, and Whitman himself too, are interested in a man by the name of Elias Hicks, who forms a kind of a branch of Quakerism known as Hicksite Quakerism. And if you go you can go out and see Walt Whitman's birth home out in Long Island, and there is it's called Hicksville, and it's named after Elias Hicks. So he also, during this time, he becomes an apprentice to a man named Samuel E. Clemens, who works for the Long Island newspaper, The Patriot. Whitman, his whole life, works in the printing press, and he begins by working on this newspaper and eventually works as a printer for other newspapers as well as a journalist, and even begins as a kind of column writer, and even writes a temperance novel in around I believe 1842. So two important aspects of his background: newspaper work and Quakerism. And let's see here. Hicks, Elias Hicks, too. So his family and Hicks also was a carpenter and a farmer. So that kind of, you can see a lot of, you know, that we might trace some of the aesthetics of labor in Whitman's work back to these sources. Hicks was also, it's important to note, a Quaker abolitionist. So Whitman had exposure to ideas about abolition early on. And many of the Quakers who lived in Long Island in the late 1700s, early 1800s, manumitted their slave, meaning they set their slaves free. So there was a real strain of abolitionist ideas running through Whitman's background and through his family. And Hicks taught unorthodox Christian views. A couple worth mentioning. One is sort of this idea of the fallaciousness of original sin. As well as, so, and part of that, you know, if we think about Whitman's interest in the body as a poet, that has some import here, that, you know, the a sort of a de-emphasizing this notion of sinfulness and original sin, and also Hicks preached the idea that it doesn't make sense that there's an external devil, or that the devil has kind of personhood. And Quakers believe in following what they call the inner light. So there's a real emphasis that this idea kind of aligns with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and the Transcendentalists in general. And in fact, Emerson's sort of famous sermon, The Lord's Supper, sort of referred to colloquially as the Lord's Supper, in which he leaves the Second Church of Boston. It's often been compared to Quaker thought. But the emphasis in Quakerism is on sort of finding God inwardly. Along with that, you have these ideas of sort of sitting still and sort of being in a meditative state or a tranquil state, and then God sort of appears through this inward light. So some of that is true, although we see in Leaves of Grass that Whitman does not commit himself to any particular religion and sort of talks about all religions as being branches of this same kind of trunk, which is the self. So again, a lot of what happens in 19th century American Romantic thought, beginning with the Transcendentalist and continuing on through Whitman, although of course there are a lot of differences between Whitman and Emerson, but this emphasis on the self as the source of where things like morality and religion and spirituality come from. And so ultimately we're sort of, you know, the theology is sort of the husks of religion or truth or God, but the self is really the seed of where those things come from. One other thing I want to mention. So when Leaves of Grass is published in 1855, you have mixed reviews. Some reviews review it positively. Of course, Whitman wrote several of his own reviews praising the book. sort of ecstatically praising it as, like, you know, sort of saying it's the finally we America has a poet, right, a bard. But there are some positive reviews not written by Whitman in there, but there's a lot of negative reviews too. One by a famous critic named Rufus W. Griswold. And so I'll give you two quotes. I'm going to post the review to our Blackboard page, but I'll give you two quotes from the review so you can hear what Griswold says. Griswold writes, "We believe that this book does express the bolder results of a certain transcendental kind of thinking, which some have styled philosophy." And Griswold spends some time in the opening of the review talking about how it's Whitman is basically sort of trying to continue to sort of bring to fruition the ideas that Emerson has already kind of suggested. And then he goes on to say this poet, and he basically puts poet in quotations to suggest that Whitman is anything but, "This poet without wit, but with a certain vagrant wildness, just serves to show the energy which natural imbecility is occasionally capable of under strong excitement." I'll say that again. "This poet, quote unquote, without wit, but with a certain vagrant wildness, just serves to show the energy which natural imbecility is occasionally capable of under strong excitement." If you read the review, you know, Griswold goes on to sort of basically talk about that this is a disgusting book, that it's full of profanity. And he sort of says that, you know, we meet these types of folks, these sort of pseudo artists like Whitman, who think that by just being bodily and profane and gross that they're somehow profound. And, you know, if we react to it with disgust or disdain, we're somehow labeled as these conservative reactionaries. And he says this is the trick that the profane pseudo artist plays on us. So I think it's interesting, in its own right as a piece of ephemera of archival material, but it's also, to kind of see what the thinking was at that time from a prominent critic. But also it's really important to sort of think about Griswold's review in terms of how unusual Whitman's poetry was. And, not only for its free verse style, which, you know, disobeys, the trimmed hedges of verse making in traditional English poetry, where you have a kind of a set meter and rhyme, and you know, the stanzas look, they're sort of, they have a certain shape, but also the content of what counts as poetry, what counts as what can be poeticized. If we're perhaps used to Whitman now because so many American poets who've come along after Whitman, as well as other poets like the Spanish poet Federico Garcia Lorca, take the kind of imagery that Whitman uses and puts it in their poetry. So we're accustomed to it on one hand. On the other hand, I think if you do read Whitman, you will be surprised by, it's hard even in 2020 to read it and not be surprised by the things that he says and talks about, that are, have been traditionally excluded from poetry. And he's right about the sort of the vagrant wildness in terms of the poetic persona that Whitman tries to cultivate, which is a very kind of distinctly, working class, and I would say kind of masculine, persona. So let's take a look at, we'll look at a couple of parts from Song of Myself, and I only ask you to read roughly the first 20 sections, but I do recommend reading the whole thing. But let's take a look at the preface. So the preface is an interesting document because it kind of says in miniature what the poems are trying to do. So it's a kind of condensation of what the poetry does. And it's very, as a piece of prose, it's kind of not very prosy. It feels like a summary that is very kind of disjointed and fragmented, but containing a lot of the exuberance of the poetry. And it's really this kind of manifesto about what the poems are trying to do, what Whitman's trying to do. Of course, he doesn't name himself in the first edition. It's anonymously published. And that's also, too, kind of the point that Whitman is trying to write a poem, be the vessel or the conduit for the poem of America. So, you know, in not putting his name on the front, it's almost like I could be, he's suggesting a certain degree of interchangeability or anonymity, that I could be anyone writing this. And it's a poetry that represents everyone. So the preface tries to sort of state, give a kind of manifesto of what's going to be in the poems. So I'll highlight a couple of lines here and talk about it. He says in the very first page, in the second paragraph, "Here is not merely a nation, but a teeming nation of nations. Here is action untied from strings, necessarily blind to particulars and details, magnificently moving in vast masses. Here is the hospitality which forever indicates heroes. Here are the ruffs and beards and space and ruggedness and nonchalance that the soul loves. Here the performance disdaining the trivial unapproached, in the tremendous audacity of its crowds and groupings, and the push of its perspective, spreads with crampless and flowing breadth and showers its prolific and splendid extravagance." And then shortly thereafter, he says, "The genius of the United States is not best or most in its executives or legislatures, nor in its ambassadors or authors or colleges or churches or parlors, nor even in its newspapers or inventors, but always most in the common people, their manners, speech, dress, friendships, the freshness and candor of their physiognomy, the picturesque looseness of their carriage." And he goes on to sort of talk about the greatness of America is that it doesn't have sort of the hierarchies that are in European societies and cultures. So certainly, you know, you see a lot of things going on here, that geography, space, and sort of the character, even the physical traits of America stand for its ideas, that it's sort of sturdy and strong, but it's de-hierarchized, and it's pluralistic. Something to sort of make a note of here, which is that, you know, it's often... The way that sort of the relationship between Emerson and Whitman is narrated involves a couple of things, a couple of basic things. One is that Emerson sort of was the progenitor of Whitman's poetry, that he was, and in fact, he's sort of the progenitor of American literature in general in this period, because it was sort of thought that there wasn't an American literature, and then Emerson sort of called for it, and then people answer the call. That's sort of how it's traditionally narrated. It's true that Whitman saw Emerson's give his a lecture that would later become called The Poet. And Whitman sort of says of Emerson that I was simmering like, you know, water, and I was water that's heated, and then he brought me to a boil. So in a lot of ways, there's a lot of similarities that, you know, because in the address, the poet Emerson says that America is a poem in our eyes. And so it's sort of, he describes it as this kind of unwritten poem, and no one has yet to write it. But what Emerson really means is that not only that we have a dearth of poets in the nation, but also that the poets that we have are not writing about what's right in front of them. That is to say that their subjects and their contents seem to deal with very abstract and kind of august subjects, and maybe even they're imitating sort of works by Milton or Chaucer or Shakespeare or something like that, or that they're looking back towards Europe, or that they're thinking about these sort of splendid and kind of august subjects. And we're not really looking at ordinary life and even especially working class life as being the subject of poetry. And Emerson tries a lot in that address to sort of highlight ordinary life as being poetic, and as he does in The American Scholar. And so Whitman does sort of really take this to heart and sort of say, I'm going to make a book of poems that is America, that essentially captures America the way that a photograph or a series of photographs could capture it. And I'm going to poeticize and elevate those things. But I also have to note here that I think, you know, it's often also said that Emerson is sort of the more spiritual or transcendental, and Whitman is sort of the more material or embodied writer. And I think that that's true to an extent. I mean, there's a lot of references to the body and sexuality and things that are just not in Emerson. But I will say, too, that Whitman here is incredibly idealistic. I mean, I think, you know, if you read Emerson carefully, what you see in Emerson is a very large disappointment with the limitations of American society. He's much more, you see a kind of skepticism as much as you do a kind of hope, but you see a kind of skepticism about Americans and America and what it's able to achieve, and a sort of sense of moral frustration or angst about American shortcomings. Whereas Whitman has a really, I think, distinct idealism about what America can be. And you see that on display in the preface.